that I haven't talked about, and it's actually an experiment that I have taken part in the past couple of years. So this is an experiment that I took part in, and it took years to complete it. And it was a very, it is a fun story. So I thought this is something that perhaps I could share with people here. And so the title of my talk is NMR Simulations of Topological Phases. So this is, from the title, you can tell that what we have done in this experiment is basically to use the NMR simulator to simulate some important property of topological phases. So so another virtue of talking about this is really I'm not an expert in experiments, and so if I say something wrong, so please don't blame me too badly for that. So and please correct me if you think that anything is inaccurate. But I tried my best to present what I understood. So these are my collaborators. These are Professor Xihua Peng and her student Zhihuang Luo are the heroes behind the experiments. And we worked out some of the theory parts is work done in collaboration with my colleague Yidun. So it is also quite a story how I got involved in experimental work in the first place. So Yidun and I went to a math conference, and some of we were interested because some of those talks were about categories and anions. And Professor Peng, an experimentalist, showed up in the meeting, and we started chatting, and that's how we got involved in that experiment. So basically, what she told us is that her lab worked on NMR simulations, and they recently, at that point in time, that is 2012, at that point in time, they have been able to simulate the ground states of the toric code model on a torus, the four degenerate ground state. They show that they have they can see these four states and so on. And so they were so we were chatting what kind of games that we could play with this nice toy, and so that led to several years of collaboration, trying to do something interesting. And at the end of the day, what we did is to say modular matrices are actually something that you could, modular matrices, these mathematical objects, are something that you could detect from these experiments, and that you can do it to such accuracy that you can actually tell whether you are in the topological phase or you have gone out of it, purely depending on experimental methods. So we were quite proud of the game that we have designed. So in case you're not completely familiar with these systems, I will start with a very brief introduction of this set of ideas related to the quantum simulator. In particular, I will say a few words about NMR simulators. And then I will say a few things about what exactly is this phase, the toric code that we are simulating. And then I will describe how we actually what we did, namely to detect some sort of phase transitions. It's an overstatement because it's a very tiny system that the experiment was actually able to simulate, but we could detect some transition based on measurement of the modular matrix. Just to say a few words about quantum simulators, I believe the idea was first proposed in the 1980 by the Russian mathematician Manin in his book, and then again, I believe independently by Feynman in his very famous speech, famous talk. So the belief is that there is a lot of there would be some tremendous speed up in doing computations using a quantum system compared to classical systems. So I believe this audience is completely familiar with that, but I'll just say a few words anyway. So classical bits are encoded in a string of zeros and ones, and in a quantum system, we could encode information by using a set of qubits, such as putting having a string of spins. They could either be in spin up and spin down, and the beauty of quantum mechanics is that you could put a state into a superposition of many such spin configurations. And so in an n qubit system, you would the Hilbert space is of size 2 to the n, and you would need 2 to the n complex coefficients to describe a state, which is a lot of information already stored in one state. And the a logic gate in a quantum system is based on unitary operations that act on these states. And so one very intuitive way of understanding the quantum speedup, I guess, is that when you work with a unitary operation that act on one state, it is actually work doing stuff to all the bases all at once. So there's rather than flipping working with a classical bit one by one, and so in that sense there is some so I believe people call that a quantum parallelism, and that gives an intuitive way of explaining why there's such advantage in working with a quantum computer. So what about a quantum simulator? So the so we know that in many different areas, such as in many studying condensed matter physics or doing quantum chemistry or some problems in biology, they are all quantum systems where the principles of quantum mechanics apply, and also these problems have the characteristics of involving many degrees of freedom, and therefore it's very difficult to compute evolution or compute things using a classical computer. And so in the same speech that I talked about, that I mentioned, Feynman says he believed that if you find there's a suitable class of quantum machines that could imitate any other quantum system, and including the physical world. So if I am not able to directly solve the problem in the physical world, I just look for a simulator that simulates whatever that happens in the actual system, and then read off the results from the quantum simulator. In which case, I would be able to solve the problem. So how does a quantum simulator works? So the idea is also pretty simple. You have a quantum system, and it would follow some unitary evolution in time. So you want to know what is phi at time t. So now what you want to do is I have a quantum system, a quantum simulator, and it also has its own Hilbert space. So I would have to map the Hilbert space of the quantum system to the Hilbert space of the simulator. Depending on what kind of unitary evolution appears in the actual system, I would have to simulate that evolution in my quantum system. And finally, I would get a final state. So how do you simulate that evolution? So one set of proposals by Lloyd, for example, is that if I am working with a problem that has notions of locality, then the Hamiltonian would be a sum over Hamiltonian would be a sum over terms that acts on some local sets of degrees of freedom, and then the unitary evolution with respect to this Hamiltonian can be broken down into a product as such, repeated r times, and if r is sufficiently large, then I would be able to approximate the actual e to the iht arbitrarily closely, and so this is roughly how things are actually implemented in a quantum simulator to simulate any unitary evolution. And then, of course, finally, you do some measurements, find out what you can find out, read off everything that you could read off in this quantum simulator, and then finally follow the unit, the linear map, and recover what you expect to see in the actual quantum system that you are interested in. So this is the basic idea of a quantum simulator. Right, so these are very simple things. And so what is an NMR quantum simulator in particular? So the NMR quantum simulator that we work with is actually this so-called liquid type NMR simulator. So what you have is, in this big machine, you have a test tube, and in this test tube there is some liquid. And this liquid is made up of molecules, where the molecules that are chosen carries non-trivial nuclear spins. And usually, you would pick molecules such that there are several atoms with several nuclei with non-trivial nuclear spin. And because of the you might pick different nuclei so that their energy levels are slightly different. And if the energy levels are, each of these nuclei have slightly different energy levels for their nuclear spins, then you would be able to control each of them independently by choosing the right set of electromagnetic wave that you send into the system. Because the nucleus, the energy levels, the splitting of energy levels is extremely small in these nuclear spins, and therefore the kind of electromagnetic waves you send in is somewhat of the order, they are radio frequency, their wavelength is something like a radio frequency waves. And so basically, if you choose your nuclei appropriately or smartly, then you would be able to mimic any, you'd be able to control individual interaction with individual nuclei with the appropriate choice of frequency that is directed to specific atoms, nuclei, and basically control their control the Hamiltonian that they are feeling individually. And of course, these are nuclear spins are the qubits that are in the problem. And so what other specifications do we know about the, this kind of machines? So first of all, it has the virtue that these things work at room temperatures and pressure. So it's some liquid, it's some solution, so it can't, it doesn't have, it doesn't work at very low temperatures. In fact, it would freeze, and so it actually works at room temperature. So that is a big plus. And because of the very weak interaction of the nuclear spin with the environment, it has extremely long coherence time of the order of seconds. And so within that that coherence time, you can actually do like thousand pulses, and so it allows you to do pretty complicated experiment within the coherence time. And as I mentioned, different molecules have slightly different energy levels, and therefore it allows you to you make use of suitable pulses to control individual nuclei. And so we're working with at room temperatures. And so what exactly are the states in? So we have a thermal state. And in fact, because the the nuclei has very fine energy splittings, therefore it is actually pretty close to a maximally mixed state, if you the thermal state that these molecules are in. And so the idea is that rather than working with a pure state, one works with a pseudo pure state. And a pseudo pure state really means that I tune the radio pulses to slightly perturb the maximally mixed state to away, slightly a little bit away from the maximally mixed state. So there is some extra stuff that came because I put in some appropriate radio frequency waves. And so psi is one plus this tiny thing. And if I want to do make some measurements with respect to this psi, so what you do is, let's say I have some particular operator and I want to measure its expectation value, then what you find is that, of course, the maximally mixed part gives you the majority, the greater part of the So if I'm measuring some magnetization, then I certainly the it is the therm or the maximally mixed part that gives you the majority of the contribution, and the perturbation gives you a smaller some tiny correction to the maximally mixed state. The point is, if I do know alpha very accurately, then I would be able to subtract this background and read off the contribution of the interesting state psi that we want to that we are actually working with. And the point is, this can actually be done, and I'm very impressed that this is possible, particularly given that the value of alpha is extremely small in reality. As I say, this is very, very close to a maximally mixed state, to the point that this alpha is of the order of one part in a million. And even then, they are able to measure, to remove the background very, very accurately and do interesting stuff with it. Another virtue of this machine is that because we are already in an ensemble, there are billions of molecules in the solution, and therefore you can directly measure, let's say, things like what you're measuring is already an ensemble average, the expectation value of any operator, and therefore there's no notion of wave function collapse. You can do an operation, and then the overall reaction of this billions of molecules directly give you an overall expectation value, so that also speeds things up, because you don't have to stop your experiment and start over because of due to issues with wave function collapse. So that is so much about NMR quantum computation, the system. So how do you actually make so what do you actually do? So the system that we work with is composed of molecules, and each molecule has five nuclear spins. So it looks roughly like a system of this sort. And we are going to make use of four of the spins to simulate our topological order. And the fifth spin would work as an ancilla. So the virtue of that is that suppose we are throwing in some arbitrary unitary evolution, some unitary transformations on the actual system. If this V is arbitrary, but if and you can have some other operations U, and if this operations is coordinated with what you do to the ancilla spin, then you can very easily read off the actual expectation value of U dagger V simply by doing measurements with respect to the ancilla spin, where this sigma acts on the ancilla. What we actually do is to make use of the ancilla to make readouts more efficient. Okay, so having discussed various things about the NMR simulator, so let me also say a few things about what we wanted to simulate, the particular specific topological phase. As a cliche, topological phases of matter are very interesting beyond the Landau paradigm. One famous example that that we could find in material is this fractional quantum Hall states. Xiaogang, for example, he had done lots of work in trying to elicit the huge phase diagram of matter, and so topological order they do not have a specific symmetries. Well, zero form symmetries, the toric model that we are interested in basically falls into this class. So also let me say a few words to motivate why we're interested in this kind of phases, and certainly because supposedly it has long-range entanglements, and so that the degeneracy on non-trivial manifolds are protected against local perturbations. The energy separation between the ground states is actually exponentially suppressed by the system size. And moreover, in 2 plus 1 dimensions, a topological phase generically has anionic excitations. And these anions, when you move them around each other, they have non-trivial statistics. Because they are robust against local perturbations, so these kinds of non-trivial statistics that you get when you break anions are very interesting candidates of quantum of implementing gates in a quantum computers, and of course they are also very promising candidates for error correcting codes because the ground state one could think of the ground state subspace as the code subspace and that. And the message, because they're encoded in topological charge, which is globally stored in the system, and so they are not so easily, or they could be easily corrected if the message is corrupted by local interactions with the environment. So that was one of the reasons why people are interested in this kind of phases. But of course, we're dealing in the experiment that is concerned, we're dealing with a small system. So the interesting properties here don't really is not really relevant. But nonetheless, this is some of the reasons why people consider them and they're important. Right, so I said something about braiding and braiding realizing quantum computation. So I have some more to say later, but the particular example that we are interested in is the toric code model. So in order to appreciate the experimental results, let me just say a few more words about what this model is about. To me, this model is just a sum C2 gauge theory, where on each link, there is a spin half degree of freedom, and the Hamiltonian is made up of two parts. The first part is sigma x acting on the four links joined at a vertex. And one could think of this as a Z2 gauge transformation, basically flipping all of the links connected to this vertex. You could think of that as a Z2 gauge transformation. So the this term here, the ground, this term here in the Hamiltonian imposes that the ground state is actually invariant, a gauge invariant is actually gauge invariant under Z2 gauge transformation. Then the second term BP is a product of 4 sigma z around a plaquette. And what that means is that you're just reading off the Z2 flux, Z2 magnetic flux going through a plaquette. And so the second term here in the Hamiltonian ensures that in the ground state, there is no magnetic flux in the ground state. Okay. And so this model has 4 different kinds of anionic excitations, and they are generated. You could pair create these anions using these Wilson loop operators. So the 4 kinds of anions are in this model. Basically, the electric excitations, magnetic excitations, and their bound states, or nothing at all. So there are 4 topological sectors. And for example, if I want to create a pair of electric charges, then I would be using these line operators, so acting sigma z on a line. So if you look at the commutation relations of the Hamiltonian, then you realize that at the endpoint of this line, it would violate the A condition. And similarly, if you take this sigma x line operator going through of the blue lines, then you realize that you have generated some non-trivial magnetic flux at the end points plaquettes. So In particular, so because of these four different kinds of anions that are found in the toric coat model, if I put this toric coat model on a torus, there would be exactly four degenerate states corresponding to using one of these corresponding to the four. So the basis states on a torus can be constructed using these line operators, winding non-trivial cycles of the torus. So and there would be exactly four such states corresponding to the four types of anions winding a non-trivial non-contractible cycle on the torus. So now what about modular matrices? So modular matrices is a characterizing property of the model, and this matrix just came from the fact that you start with a torus you start with a torus, and the S matrix corresponds to flipping the two cycles. And the T matrix corresponds to doing a den twist on the cycle. And if you work with the anion basis that I just described, namely you have anion lines are winding a non-contractible cycle as your basis, then this modular matrices tells you some non-trivial information about the anions are in this model. In particular, the S matrix tells you the mutual statistics between the anions, and the T matrix is diagonalized under this anion basis, and these eigenvalues basically tell you the self statistics of these anions. Okay, so our goal is to measure these modular matrices using the experiment. So here this slide is just to say that there were already lots of work in the literature trying to ask if I'm given some arbitrary lattice models where it supposedly in a topological order, whether those topological numbers or these modular matrices can be worked out from the lattice model. If you're not working with the an ideal model, how do you recover the S and T matrices? And actually, our ideas borrowed some of these ideas from the literature, except here we're implementing in an experiment, and I'll go into that shortly. Are there any questions at this point? Okay, so now it comes to the experiment itself. We're trying to ask how much stuff we could recover from the simulator about this Z2 toric coat model, about the Z2 topological order. The Hamiltonian that we work with is the toric coat Hamiltonian that I have written several slides earlier. This guy, the model in the Hamiltonian in the exactly solvable model. But to make it more exotic, we're going to move away from the perfect idealized exactly solvable point, and add some overall magnetic field along the z direction, and also put in some random disorder term into the Hamiltonian. So these epsilon i's are just some random numbers. Actually, it helps with the experiment. If you're interested why that is the case, we can talk later. But in any event, we're not working with the exact Hamiltonian. One reason for that is that if I work with some arbitrary Hamiltonian, then it's not clear what are the anion bases. And what we want to show in this experiment is that you don't need theoretical input to construct these anion bases. Just follow the experiment and you'll be able to recover the modular matrices in the right the appropriate basis. So let me emphasize that here. I said the modular matrices tell you about mutual statistics between anions, but that is only if you work with the right set of bases. You work with this anion basis. If you did not start with the anion basis and work with some arbitrary basis, then the S&T matrices just look like some random stuff whose meaning is not obvious. And so the idea is, without using theoretical inputs, how do you recover the S&T matrix from the experiment that is automatically in this anion basis? And when the theory is no longer topological, you should also be able to see that there's no such beautiful basis, no matter how you rotate things. How do we do that? So first of all, we are putting the system, we're simulating the topological order with only four spins. So what does that mean? So this is a particular system that we're working with. We have 1, 2, 3, 4 spins. And so it is, we're putting the system on a torus, then it means that this spin is identified with that, and this is identified with that. So you only need 4 spins to put things on a torus. Then we put in the Hamiltonian. H is the Hamiltonian that I described in this slide. And so now the first step in this experiment is to prepare the ground states. So this is H is our target Hamiltonian, and we want to be able to generate all these 4 ground states. And so one way of doing it is that you start with a Hamiltonian that is completely randomly generated. These alphas are random numbers, and then you move continuously, slowly tune this S until S goes to 1. You start from S equals 0 and then continuously take S to 1 to reach your target Hamiltonian. And if my starting point, H random, is different, then generically, when I reach S equals 1, I would generate a different state. It might not be orthogonal to the first state I've generated, but in general, it would be some different state. And so if I repeat it many times, I would be able to tell that, there are only 4 linearly independent states, and remember how I generate them, so I have remembered these states. So the first step is generate the 4 degenerate states of the target Hamiltonian on a torus by randomly choosing a starting Hamiltonian and adiabatically evolve the system to the target Hamiltonian, in which case you would be able to generate, you'll find that exactly you have 4 linearly non-independent states and remember them. Then number 2, once you have generated these 4 states, we want to implement the modular transformation. So how do you implement modular transformation? We have a system with only 4 spins on this torus, and the S transformation only corresponds to rotating this torus by 90 degrees. So if you stare at this torus, this lattice, then you immediately realize that it corresponds to, when you rotate it by 90 degrees, it just corresponds to swapping 2 of these atoms. Swapping 2 of these spots. And so this is an operation that can be readily implemented on the NMR system. It's just a swap operation, swapping 1 and 3. Similarly, the den twist is basically a shear of the torus, and if you follow the shear of the torus by 1 by tau by 1 tau to tau plus 1, then you realize that it is basically just swapping sites 1 and 2, and this is another swap operation that you can implement on the NMR system. And so the second step in our story is, after generating these 4 independent states, do a swap operation to implement the S and T matrix separately. And so then you would be able to read off the data that you have is basically a bunch of overlap before and after overlap of psi and psi uh, sorry uh, psi j as psi I. So you have a matrix of S and T separately, but they're not diagonalized matrix. It just looks like some set of numbers. Then the third step is to ask whether we could recover the modular matrices. So first of all, we started with some random basis. It's not even diagonal. So it's not even orthogonal. So we could always construct an orthonormal basis out of these four linearly independent, but not necessarily orthogonal basis. So that is the easy part. Because we already have, so the measurements of the experiment involves all the overlaps of these four states, the relative overlap between these four states. So you can work out how to find an orthonormal basis. But these bases are some random bases. They are not in nice anion bases that would tell you about statistics of the anions. So the anion basis must be related to this random orthonormal basis by some linear. It must be some linear combination that recovers the anion basis. But we don't know what that is. The question is, how do we find this stuff from this overlap data? So we put in some very simple constraints. Number one, we require that the anion basis that we construct should be orthogonal. And secondly, we require that each of these states is an eigenstate of the T matrix, because T matrix is diagonalized under the anion basis. And number three, we require that the modular matrices remain Hermitian when we express it in terms of this anion basis, and also that everything braids trivially with the identity state. So there must be one state, one anion state, which has self-statistics like a boson, and that everyone else braids with it trivially. So SA1 equals 1, not 0, I'm sorry. So I mean everything braids with, there must be some identity sector that everything braids with it trivially, this should be a 1. So basically this we have 1, 2, 3, and then 4 constraints. And then you just throw the experimental data into the computer and try to optimize this value such that all these four constraints are best satisfied. And doing that, you get a set of results. And this is the ideal S matrix. So this is the S matrix, and this is the T matrix. So you can see immediately, this is just the T matrix is 1, 1, 1, minus 1. And the S matrix has some 1 and minus 1 in different components. This is the idealized, standardized S and T matrix in the anionic basis. And here is our experimental data after optimization. So what we have done is we worked with many different values of the magnetic field that we perturb perturbing the Hamiltonian away from the idealized exactly solvable point, exactly solvable model. And this is a set of this is a spectrum of the theory of this Hamiltonian. So basically, when we started with H equals 0, you could see that the four states are almost exactly degenerate. And as you increase H, then these four states begin to split up. And eventually, and moreover, these are the excited states with anionic excitations. And as you change H, you would find that some of the energies of these excited states are lowered. And at some point, there would be a crossover between the lowest four states and the excited states. So you would expect that the modular matrix, before any such crossover occurs, it should just be you would expect that the modular matrix should still be the modular matrix of the toric model, even though we have perturbed it away from the exactly solvable point. But beyond the crossover occurs, then you would expect that the modular matrix must have some or qualitative change. It could not be the modular matrix that you get from the toroidal model. And so this is exactly what we find. So in point number 1, 2, 3, that is before the first four states cross over with the crossover with the excited states, we use our optimization method from optimizing the experimental data. And you find that basically the modular matrix has exactly the same form. It's robust against this change of age. And once you do across, once the first four states cross over with the high state, so four is just beyond the crossover, then the optimization does not lead to anything that is sensible. You still diagonalize the T matrix, but then you could see that the S and T matrix is completely, basically completely different from what you expect of the modular matrix of a Z2 topological order. So what is quite interesting is that this is a totally tiny system. There are only four spins. And even then, the modular matrix, we show that is a measurable quantity in the experiment. The fidelity of these states compared to the theoretical value when you prepare a state is always over 96-97%. The fidelity is very high, and the measurement of the modular matrix is extremely accurate. So this is basically the result of the experiment. So are there any questions here? Oh, yes, please.
How did the exact discoverable Hamiltonian enter into the experiment?
So the Hamiltonian is divided into three parts. This is the exactly solvable part, but we deliberately perturb away from the exactly solvable model. Of course, in a four spin state, everything is exactly solvable. But the point is, this theory, the H toric part, even in an arbitrary large system, it's still exactly solvable. But if you put in this term, it is not an exactly solvable model. You can tell because the operators showing up here do not commute with this term. And the point why we did that is because of a complaint of a referee. He says, look, you're working with the exactly solvable model. You prepare the states using anionic bases that you construct these anion lines in the exactly solvable models, put the states in there in this anionic eigenstates and do measure the modular matrix. That sounds too trivial. It's pointless, and that's why the experiment took such a long time, because we went back and says, okay, let's just use this experiment and forget about constructing eigenbases based on loop operators and whatsoever. Just use the experiment, whatever it gives. And that is the reason why we put in this perturbation away from this exactly solvable point. And the disorder actually put there so that you can control your adiabatic evolution so that you can actually generate the four different states. If everything is exactly on top of each other, then it's very hard to control the speed of the adiabatic change. So we need a little bit of a separation of the degenerate states based on the disorder that makes it somewhat more realistic, and at the same time, it helps with all the experiments.
I was asking, your experiment, how do you know you can reach this exactly solvable model?
Right. So the way you determine that is that actually these experiments you can read off. They can do wave function tomography. So actually, you can read off what state you have got. So they can recover exactly what the spin state you have prepared, and they would be able to tell that. It is actually within in the ground state subspace of your target Hamiltonian that the experiment has been successful. Other questions? Sorry. Oh, sorry. No, sorry.
I any questions from the students?
So so let me just finish saying a few words. So we have presented to you that in an experiment where we use basically minimal theoretical input, and the way we do the optimization and deciding which are the sensible set of rules of a modular matrix in the anionic basis. This is actually some work that has already been done in the lattice community, trying to determine the modular matrix in a generic lattice model. So we're just borrowing some of those ideas in our recovery of the modular matrix. And in fact, the implementation based on this swap operation has already been discussed in the literature. In fact, Giuffre has some papers also discussing how to implement modular transformation on a generic lattice model. So we also borrowed some of these ideas, except implementing it on an experiment. And so we show that with it looks like a very honest experiment. I'm given a Hamiltonian, and then we measure the modular matrix to show that, look, this is a toric code. This is a Z2 topological order. So of course, what we have done is a tiny, tiny system, but then it's a proof of principle that these things can be done. You can detect a phase based on experiments. And of course, the interesting thing, and of course, we were able to move away from the idealized models and show that there is a phase transitions across some crossover point. And of course, the interesting thing is, can we work with bigger systems? Of course, as far as liquid NMR simulators are concerned, that is pretty difficult, because you could imagine the way to get bigger systems is to build bigger molecules. And so it gets the levels get more and more closely spaced. It gets harder and harder to control the Hamiltonian. I think the state of the art is to do something like 10 spins, but I think the fidelity there is not is not as good, and the prospect of expanding it into way bigger system, I think, is not very promising. But we show that if you're able to work with bigger systems, the methods that we propose to implement, say, the modular transformations, which is a possible set of which is a possible set of logic gates, that the method of the complexity of that method only grows polynomially. So as in the number of swaps that you have to do in a very big lattice only grows polynomially with system size. It doesn't grow exponentially. And of course, more interesting thing is if we could simulate other topological orders and then start doing some braiding and so on to at least to show that these ideas in topological quantum computation is possible in principle, is possible, it could be realized in a semi-realistic situation that theoretical experimental techniques has reached that sensitivity. So that's all I'm going to say. Thank you very much.
Any questions from the students?
So for me, like topological order is a property in the thermodynamic limit, which is an IR property. So it seems for me like a magic that you can measure them four spins. So is my understanding right? Or
right. The point is the Titaev model, the toric code model, is a fixed point wave function already. And therefore, you can put it on any number of or spins, and it would have exactly the same properties. So the point is, now if I put in some more perturbation away from this fixed point wave function, you would expect that the property only go away slowly as you tune up the size of the perturbation, and that's why it works. So the fact that we have a fixed point wave function to start with is extremely important.
Just to follow up what you just said, so your four spin system, suppose you perturb it, I would expect the marginal matrices to change slowly as you perturbate.
It doesn't.
It should remain unchanged at all as long as you stay in the.
Right. So,
it seems it doesn't change at
all. No. It's not that it doesn't change at all. It's that the change is way less drastic compared to the H. So the in the experiment, it changes. It floats a little, but it floats very. It floats only a little. In fact, okay, this is something that I don't exactly understand why, even though it's a sparse Poisson system. Before I did the experiment, of course, we look at the actual modular matrix solved for the lower states and compute the modular matrix on Mathematica. It doesn't. The theoretical value doesn't change at all as you change H. Before the crossover, you take so when you change H, of course the states split somewhat. You follow the lowest four states and compute the modular matrix. It doesn't change at all. So I don't. Someone told me that maybe there is some is some very. Oh no! Let me not say stupid things. It's just a fact that. In fact, it doesn't change. In the experiment, it floats somewhat, but the change is not. Theoretically, this exactly this Poisson systems when you follow the lowest four states, and compute the modular matrix, it doesn't change at all.
For that particular perturbation.
That's right. So I cannot say for arbitrary perturbation, but I believe I have a feeling that it stays unchanged.
And also, you mentioned you started from some. Temperature ensemble and then perturbate to obtain some pseudo pure state.
Right.
You even know the coefficient in front of the pure state. Can you tell us more about how exactly you do it?
You mean how to measure that alpha to remove
to
the.
Prepare and to measure the alpha.
To prepare, I believe, because you have the. So suppose I want every spin to point in the same direction to initialize it before. So I think the easiest way is to initialize it so that everything points in the same direction, and that you can do with some strong magnetic field in certain directions. But then you would be able to control the directions of the magnetization. And then you use a random Hamiltonian to evolve it that to prepare to go to your target set. That's how it works.
How do you know alpha is not?
Sorry?
How do you know the coefficient?
To measure that coefficient, I don't know. I don't know how they did it. Any
other questions?
So before it ends, let me just quickly make an advertisement, which I almost forgot. So, okay. How to remove? Anyway, so because of our meeting with, because of this interesting encounter with Professor Peng, the experimentalist, we realized that perhaps it's a very good idea to have some regular interaction with experimentalists, even just to know what's going on in the experimental world. And so Yidun and I and Muxin Han from Florida Atlantic University and Professor Peng, we have been organizing some conference on that brings together experimentalists and theorists every year. And the next meeting is going to come up in July 2020. And because of this series of meetings, I have been able to travel to many different parts of China. This meeting is going to be held in Yanbin University, which is located in. Which is located at a place where you can at the same time see Russia, North Korea, and parts of China. So it's a very interesting location. And in July, it has very cool temperatures. It's not too warm at all. So please follow. So we will be announcing the precise dates shortly, and hopefully we'll be able to see you there. So it's a very, very beautiful place. And I've been able to visit many different touristic places in China because of this series of meetings. So in any event, thank you very much. Thank you.